Yukitomi cleared his throat, closed his eyes, bowed his head for a long moment. Then he began to sing. Hey, 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 hey. His voice rose and fell rhythmically, for if nothing else, Yukitomi was a good singer. Perhaps that went along with being tricky. The ducks were impressed with Yukitomi's fine singing voice. They closed their eyes and swam out and began to dance. Yukitomi poured his heart into the song, because of his stomach, of course. It was empty and growling. The ducks splashed and swayed to the song, their eyes tightly shut. Yukitomi opened one eye slightly. The water was white with the splashing the ducks made. His mouth watered at the sight of so much food, but he kept singing louder and louder. When he was certain the ducks were totally engrossed in the dance, Yukitomi rose to his feet and walked along the shore, first one way, then the other. He began to dance, too, so that if one of the ducks happened to open his eyes, he would see that Yukitomi was dancing with him. But not one did. After several passes back and forth along the shore, so that his voice came from several directions, Yukitomi waded carefully into the water. Slowly, slowly he worked his way toward the ducks as they continued to dance and splash. Then Yukitomi hefted his stick, testing his balance as he took a few practice swings, singing all the time, of course. Finally, he was in among the ducks as their fat, succulent bodies bobbed on the water in time to Yukitomi's song. He danced, making loud splashing noises himself. The ducks kept on dancing, unaware of the slobbering, hungry grin on Yukitomi's face. With a swift, skillful swing, Yukitomi bashed one of the ducks. But there was so much splashing, the others took no notice. Encouraged, he swung again. A little while later, he swung the club again and again. Soon, seven ducks were floating dead in the water, while the others continued splashing and dancing. Yukitomi could already imagine the ducks roasting over a fire, and his hunger rose like a hot wind. Throwing caution aside, Yukitomi flailed away, still singing. Several more ducks fell victim to his club, until there was not as much splashing. A duck opened his eyes and saw Yukitomi among them and several of his fellows floating lifeless on the water. "Look out," the duck cried. Fly away, or Yukitomi will kill us all." Other ducks opened their eyes to see the carnage, and in a whir of wings they fled from the hungry Yukitomi. But for many of them, it was too late. Yukitomi's song turned into a gleeful laugh as he began to gather his booty. The remaining ducks were long over the horizon out of his reach. But to a duck, their eyes had turned red because they opened their eyes during Yukitomi's song. To this day, their descendants have red eyes also. They can be seen now and then, flying above or floating on a pond, cautiously throwing red-eyed glances right and left, always on the lookout for Yukitomi. Yukitomi feasted until he could eat no more, roasting ducks over the flames from the bundle of wood he had gathered as his sacred songs. Then he found a place to sleep. So if Yukitomi comes and says he has songs for you, don't close your eyes when he sings. The trouble is, who knows what form Yukitomi might take when he comes to you? Seeing the way things are, an Easterner moved to the West to live the slow-paced, elemental lifestyle he had always yearned after. In the autumn, he purchased a rustic log house at the base of a mountain. Since his only source of heat was a wood stove, he set about laying in wood. Soon he had a very large pile of wood next to his house. But since his only preparation for winter previously had been to turn up the thermostat in his apartment, he didn't know if he had put up enough wood to keep him warm through the winter. So he decided to ask a few local people. "Go to the top of the mountain," a neighbor advised. "Up there lives a wise old Indian. He can give you the advice you need." So the Easterner climbed the mountain, which was no simple task for someone used to stairs and escalators, and found an old Indian man sitting in front of a tiny log cabin. "I was wondering," he said, getting immediately to the point. I have a wood stove to heat my house. How will I know how much wood is enough to last the winter through? The old Indian stood, walked to the edge of the mountain, looked up into the sky, into the surrounding forest, and down the mountain, and returned to his chair. More wood, he uttered. The Easterner climbed back down and went to work. And in a week or so, he had a pile of wood half the size of his house. He felt better. But soon the doubts began to creep in, so he decided to visit the old Indian once again. The climb to the top of the mountain was no easier the second time, but the old Indian was still there. I put up more wood, but I'm still not sure I have enough, he confessed. Whereupon the old Indian stood, walked to the edge of the mountain, looked up into the sky, into the surrounding forest, and down the mountain, and returned to his chair. More wood, he uttered. The Easterner climbed back down and went back to work. In 2 weeks, he doubled his wood pile, and was feeling more secure, certain now that he would stay warm through the entire winter. But he was curious about how that old Indian on a mountain knew how much wood was enough, so he decided to ask him. After yet another long, arduous climb, the Easterner found the old Indian sitting in front of his log cabin. Sir, he said, I have more than enough wood to last me through the winter. I thank you for your advice. But I must know the basis of your wisdom. I noticed you looked up into the sky and into the forest. Is that how you knew how much wood I would need to get me through the winter? Not really, replied the old Indian. Below me lives a white man, and he's been laying in wood like you wouldn't believe. That's how I knew. I asked my grandfather once, when he was in his 60s, I believe, if he could tell me what truth was. I don't think I've lived long enough to know that, he said. All I know is that without it, Iktomi would be the most powerful being on earth, and that's the truth. Having lived for more than half a century, I think I'm just beginning to gain some insight into my grandfather's reply. Truth is often difficult to distinguish. It can be a gift or a burden. It can be kind or cruel. It frequently eludes our grasp, and we find it difficult to describe. Truth, at times, can hide so well that we can't find it to save ourselves, or it disguises itself so skillfully that we walk all over it without knowing. And in the next instance, it becomes plain as day, whether we want it to or not. In the end, we learn we can't live without it. Truth is a marker along the roads we travel in life, my grandfather did say. The red road has many markers. If you choose the black road, there is only the illusion of truth. We can be influenced by truth or by illusion. Two chieftains met on a plain while their two armies waited. I have 10,000 warriors, everyone skilled with weapons and seasoned by battle. Victory will be mine, said the first chieftain. What do you have? Only the truth, replied the second chieftain. This war has decimated my people, so I face you now with an army of 1,000 children. This truth will either destroy you or glorify you. The first chieftain returned to his camp, where his army of 10,000 stood ready for battle. He ordered his army to put aside their weapons while he went into seclusion to ponder the truth his enemy had spoken. With the new dawn, he sent his chief aide with gifts of food and an offer of peace to the army of 1,000 children. The first chieftain then returned to his homeland and stood to be judged before his countrymen, fully expecting to be dishonored for his weakness. He was, instead, made a king. Sometimes truth is like the wind. You can't see it, but you can see the effect it has. Truth is also like sunrise and sunset. We see the sun come up over the eastern horizon in the morning and then disappear behind the western horizon in the evening. From the perspective of our existence on a spinning sphere, the sun appears to rise and set. In reality, the sun does neither. Reality is what is, first and foremost in our physical world. In the Lakota world, reality is, for example, that the four seasons cycle in precisely the same order year after year. Reality is that lakes and rivers freeze in the winter and thaw in the spring, that all living things die, that change is inevitable. Truth is the result of the trials and errors of life, the lessons we have learned, such as, without evil, goodness would be harder to recognize, or the first casualty of war is truth, or a bird in the hand is worth two in a bush. Some rise out of the illusions we have acquired, for example, good will always prevail over evil. Truth is subjective, as in the story of the blind men and the elephant. It is also subject to change, as in man was not intended to fly. If there is a universal human weakness, it is that we want to believe there is truth, because we want clear answers rather than illusions, and therefore we are vulnerable to anything that seems to be true. Truth consists of two parts, that which is given and that which is accepted. In the story of the trickster's song, Iktomi and the ducks created a truth, that his sticks were sacred songs.